We'll move quickly into what was planned. And like I said, this comes with great tutelage from Tammy. And though I tease a little bit about I'm the one at my house that likes to decorate, and I like Broadway musicals, and there are times that I'm far more the lady or the woman in our family by my wiring, Tammy has no problem being a lady, and I have no problem exerting myself as the man. And so I told her, I said, I need your help in sharing best that I can with the men what it means to be a wife. And that's what I'm going to try to do. When Tammy, some of you may have noticed that Tammy and I are both wearing orange Converse Chuck Taylor All-Star tennis shoes. I'll tell you how that came about. When we decided to call our marriage seminar His Shoes, Her Shoes, I looked online. I wanted to make sure there wasn't a book or a seminar or something else. We didn't really want to, you know, steal somebody else's thunder. And when I did, an image came up of an engaged couple that had taken a picture of their feet wearing red Chuck Taylors. And I said, that could be our moniker, right? We could get some Converse Chuck Taylors. I remember Chuck Taylors growing up. You either got Keds or Chuck Taylors for your tennis shoes. And then I went to the store and discovered something, and that was that they were no longer the cheap tennis shoe. When I grew up, they were just that canvas or natural color. Now they came in all sorts of colors, and they were 55, 65, 75, 85. There was even a pair for $105, and I went, his flip-flop, her flip-flop. Maybe that's going to be more economical. And then I spotted them on the shelf there, a pair of orange ones on sale for $25. And on that day, orange became my favorite color. Actually, that's not completely true. I'm from Denver, Colorado, the home of the Denver Broncos, and orange is a big part of their color scheme, so I liked it. When I moved to Oklahoma City, I don't like the OU Sooners. I like the OSU Cowboys, and they are black and orange. There's somebody over there nodding. That's all right. That's what's beautiful about repentance. You can always come back to where the Lord is, okay? So even in Tennessee, where my dad was born, in Henderson, Tennessee, they'll let me get by. It's not quite the orange of their end zone, that checkerboard of their end zone, but they'll get away with it. I just tell everybody, they say, why orange? And I say, orange, you're glad you chose Jesus. That's just my thinking about it. But the truth is, they were $25, and so orange became our color. So I sent Tammy off to the ladies' department to see if she could find a pair on sale. And when she came back, we discovered something else. And that's the fact that of this particular model of Chuck Taylors, they don't have men's and women's. They're the exact same styling. At the end of the box, it says if you're a man, it would be this size. If it's a woman, at this size. But Tammy found a pair. She handed it to me. I put them up there on the by the register. And I looked on the end of the box, and guess what I noticed? Tammy and I wear the exact same size shoe. Apparently, she's got really big feet, or maybe not. So when we got home, I said, hey, I don't want you wearing my nasty, stinky shoes, so I'm going to keep them apart. I'm going to put a W on the tongue inside my shoes so you'll always know they're mine. She goes, that's great, but you just put a W in mine. And I said, for woman, a term of endearment, you know. So our original pair, Tammy's got to have a W inside of them. And even though we wear the exact same size of shoe, we never wear each other's shoes. She never wears my dress shoes, and I don't wear her high heels. Number one, I don't have the legs for it, okay? But more to the point, I got to thinking about those high heel shoes of hers, and I thought, those must be, without a doubt, the most uncomfortable shoes that there ever were. I mean, think about it for just a moment. First of all, they're not the shape of a human foot. I mean, unless your middle toe's like really, really long, right? Can you imagine, get past the gender aspect and the jeers of all your coworkers, but can you imagine functioning the entire day in high heel shoes? Getting in and out of a pickup truck, walking across a yard that has been overly watered, a gravel parking lot, getting up on a ladder, crossing a roof, even standing all day in an office or a warehouse wearing high-heeled shoes, that would have to be a miserable way to live. For us, we talked last night that God gives us a big closet of some pretty big shoes to fill, and at times the task seems almost impossible. But I want you to imagine not the shoe being on the other foot, but the other shoe being on your foot for just a moment, and imagine what it's like to live in the pair of shoes that God has given our wives. They are tight. They are restrictive. At times, they are very uncomfortable. They are the shoes of submissiveness. And yet, I'm convinced they're the most beautiful shoes of all. So, we live in a world in which the idea or the concept of submission has fallen on hard times. It's been frowned upon. It's been spoken against. And for those who really want to make their case, they've redefined it. They've reframed it to be something that it never was, to make it even more detestable. And so, when someone speaks in terms, whether in a marriage relationship, under the rule of a government, or in some other aspect of life, about being in subjection to or submissive, it usually comes with a sneer. And that shouldn't be that way, because it is not a disgusting characteristic. It may be the most glorious characteristic that there is. Let me give you the dictionary definition, not of the word submission, but of the Greek word, the original language, that was translated to be our word submission or subject to. The submission, this particular word, literally means to yield under. The definer goes on to say, to be controlled by another, actually a Greek military term, meaning to arrange, like in troop divisions, in a military fashion, under the command of a leader, and thus in non-military use, it was, listen carefully, a voluntary attitude of giving in, cooperating, assuming responsibility, and carrying a burden. In other words, it was God's organized chain of command within the marriage relationship. Anybody in here currently or previously served in the military? Anybody in here? Okay. My apologies in advance for my military illustrations. Every time I do one, I have somebody come and go, let me clarify that. For example, I one time said a Marine drill sergeant, and afterwards this guy, about 5 foot nothing, a former Marine, came up to me with that, what's your major malfunction look on his face, and he said, in the Marine Corps, he even spoke in cadence, he goes, in the Marine Corps, not all drill instructors are sergeants. And I said, what about in the Army? And he goes, well, they are in the Army. And I go, okay, a drill sergeant in the Army. I just changed it and fixed that. For me, three up and three down is still the end of an inning. That's the end of my military knowledge. But if I can simplify it, I think I can be fair to the work of the military. On the one hand, we have our leaders, our commanders, whatever their rank is, generals, I don't understand all of that. But here they are. They are the strategists. They understand the need, the accomplishment to be achieved in this particular military campaign. They have received perhaps directive from the executive branch, but they nevertheless know what they're doing. They understand their men. They understand their artillery. And so what they do is they give their instructions by way of command. And it is the responsibility then of the soldiers to take those command and to execute those orders, to fulfill those commands in the accomplishment of battle, and win the war. In that scenario, it would seem as if these certainly highly decorated individuals are the most important. Because without them, though there might be some success in the field, in the absence of those calculated strategies and by way of command, it's going to be futile. And the hopes of winning the war ultimately is pretty thin. In fact, in times when we've seen that military might actually is absent, but what makes up for it sometime was the well-strategized instructions that were given. In other words, the leader made a difference. So it might seem that those individuals were really, really important. I think about two guys. Anybody here from Oklahoma? Before I use another Oklahoma illustration. Oh, good. This will work out perfect. My wife's from Oklahoma, so I have a fond affection for everyone who's from Oklahoma, because those who got out were smart. Anyway, two guys from Oklahoma, they're digging a ditch. Their buddy's up there as the foreman. The one looks at the other and says, excuse me, but why is he up there the foreman? We went to elementary school together. We hung out together. He didn't go to a special college. We started at this company about the same time, but he's the foreman and we're down here digging the ditch. Why is that? And the guy goes, I don't know, but I'm going to go find out. So he gets up there, he walks up to the foreman, he says, hey, why are you the foreman? We're down digging the ditch. We grew up together, we went to school together, you didn't get any special training, we started at this company about the same time. How come you're up here and we're down there? And he says, I'll show you why. I want you to take your shovel there. And he went and he put his hand up at a brick wall. He says, I want you to rear back. I want you to hit that hand just as hard as you can. Guy thought, well, if nothing else, a free shot at the foreman. He reared back and he swung that thing. And just as he got there, the foreman dropped that hand and he hit that wall solid. And like a Chinese gong, he just rattled out of there. He goes, that's why I'm the foreman. He went back, got in the ditch. He said, well, did you ask him? He goes, I did. He goes, he said, what did he say? He goes, well, take your shovel there and hit my hand. Okay? Sometimes there may be a reason, but the perception that these are more valuable because they are in the place of leadership or command is a misnomer, because in the absence of the men in the field, and for that matter women as well, what? Those commands fall on deaf ears. You can move pieces and parts all the way around a map all you want, but if there's not someone there to do what needs to be done, the battle equally fails. In fact, I did have a military guy told me, he said, here's something that you don't understand having not served in the military. And he goes, that is the mutual respect that exists between these two. He says, on the one hand, these who are the commanders, those who are in charge, they have a high regard for those men and women who are in the field. They trust that they're able to execute the orders that have been given. At the same time, those who are in the field have the utmost trust in these individuals. In other words, this is a partnership. And it brought to my mind a friend of mine who was an Apache helicopter pilot. And he described the rotor assembly in an Apache helicopter as a series of pieces and parts that are all held together, each independent in their value, but interdependent in their operation. And they were all held together by what he called the Jesus nut or the Jesus pin. Have any of you ever heard that? Basically, it's a large nut that ties the assembly together and then a cotter pin that goes through it. And the reason they call it the Jesus pin is because if it fails, the rotor assembly comes apart and there's a good chance the next person you're going to meet is Jesus, right? So what we have is we have this thing called marriage, like that rotor assembly. We have two individuals. We have a woman and a man who are both created in the image of God. God said, let us create man, and that's not gender specific. It's the word that we would say mankind. Let us create mankind in our own image, and he created them, that is the mankind, male and female. Both are created in the image of God. Equally, God said, and let us give them, that's mankind, male and female, authority, oversight over the creation. So, men and women were created in the image of God with equal abilities, but differing roles. At least initially, we see a gender difference, right? Male and female. So, we have these independent, and as we've already talked about, though, that they are interdependent with one another, each requiring the execution of the other's role to help them accomplish theirs. And they're held together by not God's Jesus nut, but by this thing that he calls marriage. And so the wife's role as a submissive has nothing to do with her superiority or her inferiority. And that's sometimes where the definition in our world goes awry. Because the thought is that if someone's a submissive, it means they're a lesser. And I would suppose that we as men do not do much to kick against that, but instead we kind of feed that fire if we have the perspective that, well, I'm the master and she's the slave. That I am the Batman and she is the Robin. You know, I have the best costume, the best superpowers. I know, Batman doesn't have superpowers. And Robin, his job is to sit back there and simply brush my cape out of her face when the wind blows, right? That I'm Yogi and she's Boo Boo, any number of those that might imply that she in any way or respect is an inferior is wrong. In fact, I can prove that biblically. And I do so with the most perfect example of all examples, Jesus himself. In the book of Philippians, the Apostle Paul is writing to the church in Philippi, and he's simply encouraging them to think of the things of others over your own self. And in Philippians chapter 2, verses 5 through 8, he gives the illustration of Jesus, and as he pens it, he said, he, speaking of Jesus, although he existed in the form or the very nature of God, did not regard equality with God a thing to be held on to, but he emptied himself. He goes on to say that Jesus not only took on the appearance of a man, but also the very nature of a man. And he humbled himself even to the point of death. So we have this principle, though the word submission isn't used, the principle is, and that's this. We have Jesus who clearly is the creator and sustainer of the world. Genesis 1, John 1, Colossians 1 and 2. Jesus created the world by his power. It was not only created but sustained. He did so for his purposes. In other words, he didn't rely on anybody. He doesn't give an account to anybody. He's not just capital G God. He's capital G-O-D God. He's the Alpha of the Alphas. He's the top of the ladder. There is no above him. All are below him. But for a time, 33 and a half years as we measure it, he humbled himself. He went from the one that needed no one to being an infant, a child. Some have looked at Philippians chapter 2 and tried to figure out everything that Jesus emptied himself of. And if that's the purpose of that passage, I think it's deficient because I can't make heads or tail out of all. I like to use this illustration. That on the day that he stepped away from the throne, it wasn't that he couldn't be God. It meant that he couldn't be God and go and offer himself as a sacrifice. In other words, for your and my sake, he took a lesser role. Here's what he did. He takes off the crown. He takes off the robe. He lays down the scepter. He leaves the throne room. And like a king who wants to walk amongst the commoners, he wraps himself in the apparel of humanity and he walks amongst them. He is hungry as they are hungry. He is sad as they are sad. If he steps upon a thorn, he feels the pain. And though he never takes the opportunity, he is presented with, Peter says, he's presented with the opportunities to sin in the same way. In other words, he lives in the same broken world. But here's what we know about the king. Even though he looks like the commoner, he still is king. And the grammar of the original language bears that out. We see that word in a past tense. He, although he existed in the form or nature of God, we see that as how he was at the beginning. But that particular word, you remember when you were in elementary school, we had to learn that stuff like past, present, and future. I ran, I will run, I am running. You had to learn it all that way, or at least we were supposed to. Didn't make much sense then. Well, it's even more confusing when you get to Greek because they have more than past, present, future. And this particular word means this. He exists. But it'd be bad English grammar to say he exists in the form of God when you're speaking past time, but that would be more proper. It's why when Exodus chapter 3, Noah sees a bush that's burning but not consumed, and the voice, which I believe is the pre-incarnate Jesus, that it speaks in answer to the question, who do I tell Israel is sending me? And the voice says, you tell them, I am. I am the existing one, the one who exists, the one who is always in the present, even when he's in the past. And if that doesn't hurt your head, you're not paying attention. But that's who he is. He's not limited by time. He's not limited by space. The point is this. You're going, because we're not talking about marriage. I kind of remember those two guys. They came up from Texas to Colorado to hunt elk. And they shot a big old buck, and they're dragging it to the truck. But if you've ever killed an animal like that, you know that if you slide it against the grain of the hair, it catches all the underbrush, makes it twice as hard to drag. So a couple hunters came by and said, you know, if you drag that the other way, the hair lays down smooth, whole lot easier to slide. And the two Texans, man, they just started dragging it. He says, oh, man, this is a whole lot easier. And he goes, I know, but we're getting a long way from the truck. Not a lot of hunters in here. I see that, okay? So you're thinking we're getting a long way from the truck, but here's what it has to do with marriage. Jesus took a submissive role. He went from the creator of the universe to someone who had to be cared for completely. He wasn't even able to speak. He needed to be diapered. He needed to be fed. He needed to be cared for. He was completely dependent as he took this submissive role. But from the time he was in the throne room to the time he became flesh, to the time that he was exalted, he never quit being all 100% God. He didn't exchange humanity for his divinity. He maintained his divinity while he took on his humanity. And so when a wife who is created in the image of God is given independent value, submits herself, she is not becoming a lesser. She's not becoming an inferior. In fact, Philippians chapter 2 goes on to say that once that work was done, God did what? He glorified him. He exalted him. In other words, there was an honor bestowed upon him for doing that, even though he was due all the honor in the first place. And so we have a wife that takes a role and puts her feet into those little constraining shoes of submissiveness. And some of us think, you know, that ain't much of a job. That's pretty easy. That's pretty cushy. And I would challenge you that it's not. I will say that at times it's probably less than attractive. Before my dad's passing a number of years ago, he believed that the very best tire that you could put on your car was what he called the Michelin tire. Now, the Michelin tire is a pretty good piece of rubber on a car, and you pay dearly for it. It performs well, lasts longer, but it has a price tag on it. But I can tell you from personal experience, though I don't have time to share the full story, that it does not matter what kind of tire you have on your car if the $2.50 lug nuts on the wheel fail, except to see how high that tire bounces as it goes through the ditch. Now, I don't want you to tell your wife that I said that she was the stud on a tire and you're the Michelin. But I do mean it this way, that at times that thing that seems to be unsightly, that is submissiveness, utilitarian, inferior in some ways, is ultimately valuable. So not only is it not always appealing to be submissive, it's really, really hard to be submissive. Let's take, for example, the relationship that we have with Jesus Christ. Let's get past the gender aspect of it for just a moment, but Jesus is described as the groom of the church of which most, if not all of us, are a part, and that the bride is the church. So that means that us individually are the bride of Christ, and he is the perfect husband. He is one who cares and loves always for his bride. He always is seeking her best interest, our best interest. He doesn't lash out in unwarranted anger. In fact, he has demonstrated the ultimate love by willing to die for us. And sometimes I have a hard time submitting to him. Not because of him, because it's hard to be submissive. I'm a pull myself up by my own bootstraps. I didn't want to take my wife's name at our wedding. I wanted her to take mine. I shared with somebody a little earlier. In my car, I like to be the driver. Not that Tammy's a bad driver, but I like to be in control of my own life. That's the kind of guy I am, and it is hard for me to submit to a perfect spouse in the person of Jesus. Meanwhile, there's you and I. We're finding our way through this thing calling being a husband. We are not always the most loving and caring. We do not always sacrifice ourselves. We rarely are actually die for our wife, and we're certainly at times not willing to live for her. We do lash out sometimes in unwarranted anger. We think about ourselves over her, and yet our wife quietly slips on those shoes of submissiveness. Not because we're worth it, but because she's being submissive to someone who is greater than the two of us. That's hard to do. It's hard to do when Jesus we submit to. It's even harder to do with you and I, who at times can be buffoons. I hope that's not a euphemism for a bad word, but it's what it is. We're buffoons. So, we have to get that understanding of submissiveness, but at the same time, the wife needs to understand, it's what Tammy shared with the ladies right now, what submissiveness looks like. Submissiveness is not this. Fine. It's not digging all four hooves in as the husband drags the wife along, and just because they're going the same direction, she in some way has submitted. What it means is, as that definition said, it is a voluntary attitude of giving in, cooperating, assuming responsibility, and carrying a burden. Let's take it away from the marriage for the purpose of illustration for a moment. Let's go to the corporate world. Big boardroom, giant oak table there. The board of directors is surrounding that. They're making the decisions regarding the direction of the company. Maybe it's something they're going to invest in or something that they're going to modify. And so they go around the table. And for the most part, the decision is that it seems the consensus is that we should go this way. One of the board members stands up and says, I don't agree with that. I think it's a bad idea. And here's why. And he offers his reasoning. And there's some discussion, there's some debate, I don't know, maybe even emotions flare in the whole thing, but finally it comes time to make a decision. They decide to go the way of the majority, and the one guy is left out as far as his perspective. Now, he's got three opportunities. The first is, I quit. I'm not going to be any more part of this tomfoolery. I'm out of here. Secondly, he could do the fine. But when this thing all goes belly up, don't come crying to me. I'm the guy that had the voice of reason and said we shouldn't do it. The third, which really is the illustration of submissiveness, that's when he says, very well, I default to the wisdom of the whole for the well-being of the company. Not only will I go along, I'm going to be on the front lines doing absolutely everything I can to make this the best decision our company has ever made. Now, when you have board members with that kind of perspective, do you know what happens to those corporations? They flourish. Let's go something maybe a little closer to home. In a local congregation, a group of elders, a group of shepherds discussing not the direction of doctrine, those things are already set, but maybe they're talking about the need to expand the building. Do we build on? Do we remodel? Do we rent? Do we sell this? Build something new? Do we buy something that's already in existence? And so they're having a discussion. And for the most part, they're leaning then one particular way. And one of the shepherds says, I don't think that's a good idea. He has a perspective. He shares his perspective. There's some discussion. There's some debate. There's even the possibility that maybe emotions get kind of ramped up in all of that conversation. Finally, it's time for them to make a decision, and the decision is made by consensus, not 100%, but we're going to go this way. That one elder says, well, I got one of three choices. The first is, I resign. I am not going to be part of this anymore. Number two is, well, fine, but I'll just tell you right now, if anybody asks me, I'm going to tell them it's a terrible idea. I'm not going to be in part of it. The third is, very well, I'm going to submit to the wisdom of the whole for the well-being of this church. Not only am I going to go along, I'm going to be out front, and I'm going to do whatever I can to make this the best decision this church has ever done. And you know what happens in churches where shepherds have that mindset, a mindset of submissiveness? They flourish. Now let's go to a marriage. Husband comes in and says, hey, I saw online a great job opportunity in Cleveland. I think I should pursue it. And his wife said, says no one ever, right? You're from Cleveland. I've been there. It's a great town. But I'm just saying, she goes, uh-uh. And so they have some discussion. They have some debate. In fact, let me add this. You would be foolish to not consider her input. This is a team thing. It's not just you giving orders. And so they have some discussion. They have some debate. It's a pretty big decision. Maybe even tensions are elevated. But finally, the husband says, after all that, yeah, I'm not only going to pursue it. If they offer me the job, I'm going to take it. Now, the wife has those same three options. Well, good, have a terrible life, because I'm not going. I quit. Or, fine, but I can just tell you when we get there, I'm going to be slow to unpack boxes, because when you find out how boneheaded this decision was, I won't have to repack everything when we come back to where we should have stayed in the first place. Or, she says, very well. She goes, I understand the arrangement that God has put in the marriage relationship. And as a result of that, I am going to submit to your wisdom for the well-being of our family in keeping with God's organizational structure. And not only am I going to go along, I'm going to do everything I can. Because see, in her mind are the instructions that come clearly for Scripture. We mentioned one of them last night. And that's in Genesis chapter 3 when Adam and Eve both eat of the tree. And God said, your desire shall be for your husband and he shall rule over you. Whether or not that was always the intended arrangement or if it came about as a result of that sin, the woman was given a submissive role. We come over and we look at passages like 1 Peter chapter 3 in a discussion of submissiveness in general. Government and citizens and masters and slaves. And though the three are not all equal across there, there is an equality in them. And that is a wife who apparently has a husband who's not a believer. And she is, at least to the extent that does not violate God's law, to be submissive to him, even if he is not a godly man in every respect. We know in the book of Titus, the letter to Titus, seems as if there was a church in disarray there. It's the reason Titus was there and he was to put some things in order. And amongst the things to put in order, he said, tell the older women to teach the younger women how to love their husband and to be submissive to him. And in what every husband's favorite verse is from Ephesians chapter 5, right? We draw it like a gun. Wives, be in subjection to your husband, right? Kind of forgetting sometime the one that follows, and love your wives as Christ loved his church. There's no doubt that a wife understands her role of submissiveness as it is given by God, not by her husband. She's not really just submitting to you and I in our imperfections, but submitting to him, and that is hard. In fact, within that statement that God makes to Eve, when he says, your desire shall be for your husband, it might sound to the cursory reader that what he's saying is, well, you're going to want your husband, and I think that's punishment enough. But that's not what it means. It says simply in our modern vernacular, you're going to want to wear the pants of the family every day. That's going to be something that is going to be a daily challenge. And I will say again, our greatest difficulty in this is not the influence of so-called feminism. The greatest difficulty in this is men who won't be men. Men who won't take their God-given role. I told you I like to drive. But sometimes when we used to drop my kids off at Oklahoma Christian in Oklahoma City and head back to Denver, it's a relatively easy drive. Highway virtually all the way. You go north on 235 out of, 135 out of Oklahoma City. When you get to Salina, Kansas, you hang a left to the west, straight in on I-70 into Denver, Colorado. Easy drive unless you've been gone for a long weekend. It's late in the afternoon. The sun's beginning to set. It's warm in the car. Everybody else has gone to sleep. You begin to explore what both lanes look like. Aunt Tammy will go, "You want me to drive?" And I go, I'm fine now. I'm just doing great, you know? But if I go out, if I go to sleep, I take my hands off the wheel, you know what she's going to do? Just sit back and take it. No, she's going to grab the wheel. She's going to nudge me. She's going to say, somebody's got to drive this. And in the absence of strong male spiritual leadership, many women who aren't desiring to take over the role of man said, somebody's got to drive this car. And we're finding them in single parent homes where it's a mother there trying to raise her kid, being both mother and father because men aren't doing what's supposed to be. Or some of those mothers who are raising their kids even when father is present because he's too busy with whatever else he's got to do. And they go, well, she's a feminist. You know what? She's trying to be the man in all of this. Now, the fact is, she is smart, created in the image of God, and quite capable probably to do our job, but she knows it's not her job to do, but at times it needs to be done, and she steps over those lines because she has to or is forced into it. But being submissive is not an easy job for a wife because she's smarter, probably. She's certainly more insightful at times, and she's absolutely better looking than any of us. But she says, where are those small shoes? Where's that place of submissiveness? Here's the pill that, for me, is the hardest. I mentioned God created everything, and he said it's good. He looked over at Adam. I don't know why I picture him this way. Stark naked, just realized that this finger fits perfectly in this nostril, and he goes, not so much. It is not good that man should be alone. He creates Eve for him. And now he says, it is very good. Here's the implications of that. I am convinced that a man cannot reach his fullest potential without a woman by his side. That does not mean you have to be married to make it to heaven. That doesn't mean that single men are displeasing to God. But what it does mean is God said, by ourselves, we can't do completely what we need to do. That's why he gave us that helper or that helpmeet. Terrible translations in most of the versions, in my unscholared opinion. And the reason why is because that word helpmeet or helper shares the same root as a song that we sing that nobody rarely ever understands. Here I raise my Ebenezer. You know that one? I only knew one Ebenezer growing up, and he was not very nice at Christmas time, right? But it means stone of strength. Well, that Ezer part is part of this word of helper. And here's what God said. He goes, I will give him a strength. A wife is given to us as a strength or as a power for us to accomplish what he has charged us to do. Now, I will tell you, I feared at one point in time that maybe I sent Tammy off in a breakout and she might be running a rebellion and we didn't even know about it. I mean, I thought she might get in there and say, you know, there are twice as many women on the planet as there are men. We should rule this marble, and away she goes. Kind of one of those Planet of the Apes moments. Don't tell your wife I thought of them as Planet of the Apes, but you know what I'm talking about, right? So I took a peek at her notes, and you know what she said? She said the wife is the shoe insert for her husband. And I thought, well, that's unsightly. But it resonated with me, and here's why. Though they may be fashionable, the Chuck Taylor All-Stars are perhaps the worst tennis shoe that has ever been created. They are nothing more than a piece of stamped rubber on the bottom. And though at my first seminar wearing one, I thought I was young, I realized the next morning, after having stood on a multi-purpose room tile floor the whole day in nothing but this stamped rubber, how old I really was. My back hurt, my legs hurt. I had to do what I thought I'd never have to do. Guys that are young, you're going to dread this day. I had to go to the old man section of the Walmart. You know where they have the knee pads, I mean the knee braces and the elbow braces and the crutches and the bunion pads, and I had to buy a pair of shoe inserts. Now, I'm not that old. I didn't get the $50 ones. I got the two for $3.96 ones. And I put them in my shoes. In fact, they're in these tennis shoes today. And you know what? I realized the strength that is found with a shoe insert. To understand the value, the strength of a wife alongside of us to help us accomplish our purpose cannot be measured. That's how valuable it is. And God has called our wife to do that. And it is, I mean, just imagine being a shoe insert in your nasty shoes, in doing those dirty deeds, in being submissive, even though she's capable of taking the reins and probably running it better than you, but she's willing to do it out of a love for you, out of her submissiveness for God, and a desire to be what God wants her to be. I think those are the most beautiful shoes of all. Now, by now, it may be that the shoe analogies are lost on you, so let me see if I can give you a better picture. If you are a golfer, it is the beauty of that helicopter shot that goes down the 18th at Augusta in Georgia, the home of the Masters, and you go, oh, to play there. If you're a fisherman, it's one of those high Rocky Mountain streams where it's just you and nature and a fish that is looking for the lure that you just tied on the end of your fly line, kind of beautiful. It's that buck that's a couple of hundred yards away who turns broadside and looks at you with that, I'll just stand here and see if you think you can hit the broadside of a buck, kind of beautiful. Anywhere near here, is there a Bass Pro Shop or a Cabela's? Or have we ever been to one of those? You ever been to one of those and in the back they have the boat cathedral? You know the boat cathedral? It's got the glass up on top and around and angelic rays of light come in. In fact, you can almost hear the awe of the angels. You walk back there, there it sets before you. That Tracker bass boat, 26 foot with that mercury outboards, black and red and silver, 156 12 a month, not that I was looking for it, but I went there, and you approach it with the reverence of a bank of urinals at a public arena, you know, just eyes forward, you don't look right or left, you don't talk, you just sit there and bask in it. And then all of a sudden, this guy, he breaks the silence, and he says to me, it's beautiful, isn't it? I had to respond. I went, it sure is. You got allergies? Yeah, me too. Uh-huh. It's that kind of beautiful. It is all right for you to admire your wife's shoes. In fact, if I asked you, do you know what kind of shoes your wife is wearing this morning? You might go, I have no idea what she's wearing. Or you might go, yeah, she's wearing those same old ugly gray Crocs that she always wears. Here's what she's wearing. She's wearing the shoes of submissiveness. That's why she's down in that other room with Tammy. How can I be the woman that God has called me to be? And so when she comes back in, even if she wears those ugly gray Crocs, lean over and tell her, I love your shoes. They're beautiful. I hope that you have a greater regard for the role that she plays in our marriage relationship, and that submissiveness is seen not as her inability, but perhaps between the two of you, the greatest character and the greatest asset.